you keep coming back to, and that is agency. In, yeah. in a context in which you don't have access to the media, perhaps your internet, social media is limited for a variety of reasons, but here to do something in a space that thousands of people maybe pass every day, it is a form of agency that is, I think, more than just doing like a social media post, let's say.
Well, and of course, your social media, and again, this is what we talk about in class all the time, your social media, sometimes you're in an echo chamber, you're in a bubble. Whereas here, if you write Lukashenko sucks on the middle of a bus stop in the middle of Minsk, by the way, the bus stops are clear, they were back in the day, and people can see you doing it. They can see you standing there. It, again, it takes great personal risk and potentially professional risk and risk to your family and loved ones. And if you are going to make that kind of statement publicly. And so there is, it is a lot of agency. I mean, you really have to, you go out, you make the stencil, you cut it, you get the paint, you think about what color you want, you put it in the place you want. There are a lot of steps that go into the process. So it isn't just, you know, going out with a Sharpie.
Right. And then you have to be ready to run from the cops if you need to.
Oh my gosh, totally. And, or the police or like the, you know, condo commandos or whoever's coming after you. But then that's probably some of the reason that in some of these highly censored, self-censored and pure censored states, not even necessarily from the authorities, you will have more graffiti that is about more explicit political issues and more beautiful murals. You know, you asked earlier about the difference between stencils and freehand and murals. So in a place like Minsk, downtown, yes, you might see Lukashenko sucks on a bus stop. But if you go to the outskirts of town to these abandoned parking garages that, you know, look a lot like Detroit, you know, in 2010, you can see these huge murals about freedom and Pohonia and dreams of the future when we are able to celebrate the Belarusian language, for example. So you do see that. It is just not, sometimes it is hidden away.
That was Alexis Lerner. Alexis Lerner is an assistant professor of political science at the United States Naval Academy. She's the author of Post-Soviet Graffiti, Free Speech in Authoritarian States, published by University of Toronto Press. You can see the Alexis Gallery of Graffiti at postsovietgraffiti.com.
Thank you very much, Rusana. I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
This episode was edited and mixed by Daniel Cooper. Like all our episodes, check out Daniel's services at podcutsediting.com. And as you know, this is the Eurasian Knot, and we're sponsored for the time being by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh, and listeners just like you. If you don't have any money to help us out, then you can help us out in other ways. Write a review, share it, spread the word. You know, we always need more listeners. And give your general support to our little project here. So until next time,
bye-bye.
Bye.
Travel by my dragonfly. No, it's not in Spain, but all the same, you know it's a groovy name, and the wind's just right.
Look out, baby.
Hey!
Hang on, my darling. Hang on, hang on if you wanna go.
Take a little bit of Spanish castle, man.
The clouds are really low, and they overflow with cotton candy, and battlegrounds red and brown. But it's all in your mind, and don't waste your time thinking about bad things. Just float your little mind around.
What I say?
Hang on, my darling. Hang on. Wanna go right now. Flip it off. Stay tuned in every time.
Richard decided that there was only one way to avoid having to watch Dirk eat his way through all the rest of the pizza, and that was to eat the rest himself. He rolled it up and took a token nibble of the end. It was rather good. He took another bite. Dirk watched this with startled dismay. So, said Richard, the idea behind Schrödinger's cat was to try and imagine a way in which the effects of probabilistic behaviour at a quantum level could be considered at a macroscopic level, or, let's say, at an everyday level. Yes, let's, said Dirk, regarding the rest of the pizza with a stricken look. Richard took another bite and continued cheerfully. So, you imagine that you take a cat and put it in a box that you can seal completely. Also in the box you put a small lump of radioactive material and a phial of poison gas. You arrange it so that within a given time period there is an exactly 50-50 chance that an atom in the radioactive lump will decay and emit an electron. If it does decay, then it triggers the release of the gas and kills the cat. If it doesn't, the cat lives, 50-50, depending on the 50-50 chance that a single atom does or does not decay. The point, as I understand it, is this. Since the decay of a single atom is a quantum-level event that wouldn't be resolved either way until it was observed, and since you don't make the observation until you open the box and see whether the cat is alive or dead, then there's a rather extraordinary consequence. Until you do open the box, the cat exists in an indeterminate state. The possibility that it is alive and the possibility that it is dead are two different waveforms superimposed on each other inside the box. Schrödinger put forward this idea to illustrate what he thought was absurd about quantum theory. Dirk got up and padded over to the window, probably not so much for the meager view it afforded over an old warehouse on which an alternative comedian was lavishing his vast lager commercial fees, developing into luxury apartments, as for the lack of view it afforded of the last piece of pizza disappearing. Exactly, said Dirk. Bravo. But what's all this got to do with this detective agency, said Richard. Oh, that. Well, some researchers were once conducting such an experiment, but when they opened up the box, the cat was neither alive nor dead, but was in fact completely missing, and they called me in to investigate. I was able to deduce that nothing very dramatic had happened. The cat had merely got fed up with being repeatedly locked up in a box and occasionally gassed, and had taken the first opportunity to hoof it through the window. It was, for me, the work of a moment to set a saucer of milk by the window and call Bernice. In an enticing voice, the cat's name was Bernice, you understand. Now, wait a minute, said Richard. And the cat was soon restored, a simple enough matter, but it seemed to create quite an impression in certain circles, and soon one thing led to another, as they do, and it all culminated in the thriving career you see before you. Wait a minute, insisted Richard, slapping the table. Yes? Inquired Dirk innocently. Now, what are you talking about, Dirk? You have a problem with what I have told you? Well, I hardly know where to begin, protested Richard. All right, you said that some people were performing the experiment. That's nonsense. Schrödinger's cat isn't a real experiment. It's just an illustration for arguing about the idea. It's not something you'd actually do. Dirk was watching him with odd attention. Oh, really? He said at last. And why not? Well, there's nothing you can test. The whole point of the idea is to think about what happens before you make your observation. You can't know what's going on inside the box without looking, and the very instant you look, the wave packet collapses and the probabilities resolve. It's self-defeating. It's completely purposeless. You are, of course, perfectly correct as far as you go, replied Dirk, returning to his seat. He drew a cigarette out of the packet, tapped it several times on the desk, and leant across the desk and pointed the filter at Richard. But think about this, he continued. Supposing you were to introduce a psychic, someone with clairvoyant powers, into the experiment, someone who is able to divine what state of health the cat is in without opening the box, someone who has, perhaps, a certain eerie sympathy with cats, what then? Might that furnish us with an additional insight into the problem of quantum physics? Is that what they wanted to do? It's what they did. Dirk, this is complete nonsense. Dirk raised his eyebrows challengingly. All right, said Richard, holding up his palms. Let's just follow it through. Even if I accepted, which I don't for one second, that there was any basis at all for clairvoyance, it wouldn't alter the fundamental undoableness of the experiment. As I said, the whole thing turns on what happens inside the box before it's observed. It doesn't matter how you observe it, whether you look into the box with your eyes or, well, with your mind, if you insist. If clairvoyance works, then it's just another way of looking into the box. And if it doesn't, then, of course, it's irrelevant. It might depend, of course, on the view you take of clairvoyance. Oh, yes, and what view do you take of clairvoyance? I should be very interested to know, given your history. Dirk tapped the cigarette on the desk again and looked narrowly at Richard. There was a deep and prolonged silence, disturbed only by the sound of distant crying in French. I take the view I have always taken, said Dirk eventually, which is that I am not clairvoyant. Really, said Richard, then what about those exam papers? The eyes of Dirk gently darkened at the mention of the subject. Coincidence, he said in a low, savage voice. A strange and chilling coincidence, but nonetheless a coincidence. One, I might add, which caused me to spend a considerable time in prison. Coincidences can be frightening and dangerous things. Dirk gave Richard another of his long, appraising looks. I have been watching you carefully, he said. You seem to be extremely relaxed for a man in your position. This seemed to Richard to be an odd remark, and he tried to make sense of it for a moment. Then the light dawned, and it was an aggravating light. Good heavens, he said. He hasn't got to you as well, has he? This remark seemed to puzzle Dirk in return. Who hasn't got to me? He said. Gordon. Well, no, obviously not. Gordon Way. He has this habit of trying to get other people to bring pressure on me to get on with what he sees as important work. I thought for a moment. Never mind. What did you mean, then? Ah, Gordon Way has this habit, has he? Yes, I don't like it. Why? Dirk looked long and hard at Richard, tapping a pencil lightly on the desk. Then he leaned back in his chair and said as follows. The body of Gordon Way was discovered before dawn this morning. He had been shot, strangled, and then his house was set on fire. Police are working on the theory that he was not actually shot in the house because no shotgun pellets were discovered there other than those in his body. However, pellets were found near to Mr. Way's Mercedes 500 SEC, which was found abandoned about 3 miles from his house. This suggests that the body was moved after the murder. Furthermore, the doctor who examined the body is of the opinion that Mr. Way was in fact strangled after he was shot, which seems to suggest a certain confusion in the mind of the killer. By a startling coincidence, it appears that the police last night had occasion to interview a very confused-seeming gentleman who said that he was suffering from some kind of guilt complex about having just run over his employer. That man was a Mr. Richard Macduff, and his employer was the deceased, Mr. Gordon Way. It has further been suggested that Mr. Richard Macduff is one of the two people most likely to benefit from Mr. Way's death, since Wayforward Technologies would almost certainly pass at least partly into his hands. The other person is his only living relative, Miss Susan Way, into whose flat Mr. Richard Macduff was observed to break last night. The police don't know that bit, of course, nor, if we can help it, will they. However, any relationship between the two of them will naturally come under close scrutiny. The news reports on the radio say they are urgently seeking Mr. Macduff, who they believe will be able to help them with their inquiries, but the tone of voice says that he is clearly guilty as hell. My scale of charges is as follows, £200 a day plus expenses. Expenses are not negotiable and will sometimes strike those who do not understand these matters as somewhat tangential. They are necessary and, as I say, not negotiable. Am I hired? Sorry, said Richard, nodding slightly. Would you start that again? Chapter 17. The electric monk hardly knew what to believe anymore. He had been through a bewildering number of belief systems in the previous few hours, most of which had failed to provide him with the long-term spiritual solace that it was his bounden programming eternally to seek. He was fed up, frankly, and tired and dispirited. And furthermore, which caught him by surprise, he rather missed his horse. A dull and menial creature, to be sure, and, as such, hardly worthy of the preoccupation of one whose mind was destined forever to concern itself with higher things beyond the understanding of a simple horse. But, nevertheless, he missed it. He wanted to sit on it. He wanted to pat it. He wanted to feel that it didn't understand. He wondered where it was. He dangled his feet disconsolately from the branch of the tree in which he had spent the night. He had climbed it in pursuit of some wild, fantastic dream, and then had got stuck and had to stay there till morning. Even now, by daylight, he wasn't certain how he was going to get down. He came for a moment perilously close to believing that he could fly, but a quick-thinking, error-checking protocol cut in and told him not to be so silly. It was a problem, though. Whatever burning fire of faith had borne him, inspired on wings of hope upwards through the branches of the tree in the magic hours of the night, had not also provided him with instructions on how to get back down again when, like altogether too many of those burning, fiery nighttime faiths, it had deserted him in the morning. And speaking, or rather thinking, of burning fiery things, there had been a major burning fiery thing a little distance from here in the early pre-dawn hours. It lay, he thought, in the direction from which he himself had come when he had been drawn by a deep spiritual compulsion towards this inconveniently high but otherwise embarrassingly ordinary tree. He had longed to go and worship at the fire, to pledge himself eternally to its holy glare, but while he had been struggling hopelessly to find a way downwards through the branches, fire engines had arrived and put the divine radiance out, and that had been another creed out of the window. The sun had been up for some hours now, and though he had occupied the time as best he could, believing in clouds, believing in twigs, believing in a peculiar form of flying beetle, he believed now that he was fed up, and was utterly convinced, furthermore, that he was getting hungry. He wished that he had taken the precaution of providing himself with some food from the dwelling place he had visited in the night, to which he had carried his sacred burden for entombment in the holy broom cupboard. But he had left in the grip of a white passion, believing that such mundane matters as food were of no consequence, that the tree would provide. Well, it had provided. It had provided twigs. Monks did not eat twigs. In fact, now he came to think of it, he felt a little uncomfortable about some of the things he had believed last night, and had found some of the results a little confusing. He had been quite clearly instructed to shoot off, and had felt strangely compelled to obey, but perhaps he had made a mistake in acting so precipitately on an instruction given in a language he had learnt only 2 minutes before. Certainly, the reaction of the person he had shot off at had seemed a little extreme. In his own world, when people were shot at like that, they came back next week for another episode. But he didn't think this person would be doing that. A gust of wind blew through the tree, making it sway giddily. He climbed down a little way. The first part was reasonably easy, since the branches were all fairly close together. It was the last bit that appeared to be an insuperable obstacle, a sheer drop which would cause him severe internal damage or rupture, and might in turn cause him to start believing things that were seriously strange. The sound of voices over in a distant corner of the field suddenly caught his attention. A lorry had pulled up by the side of the road. He watched carefully for a moment, but couldn't see anything particular to believe in, so he returned to his introspection. There was, he remembered, an odd function call he had had last night, which he hadn't encountered before, but he had a feeling that it might be something he'd heard of called remorse. He hadn't felt at all comfortable about the way the person he had shot at had just lain there, and after initially walking away, the monk had returned to have another look. There was definitely an expression on the person's face which seemed to suggest that something was up, that this didn't fit in with the scheme of things. The monk worried that he might have badly spoilt his evening. Still, he reflected, so long as you did what you believed to be right, that was the main thing. The next thing he had believed to be right was that having spoilt this person's evening, he should at least convey him to his home, and a quick search of his pockets had produced an address, some maps, and some keys. The trip had been an arduous one, but he had been sustained on the way by his faith. The word bathroom floated unexpectedly across the field. He looked up again at the lorry in the distant corner. There was a man in a dark blue uniform explaining something to a man in rough working clothes, who seemed a little disgruntled about whatever it was. The words, "until we trace the owner," and "completely batty, of course," were gusted over on the wind. The man in the working clothes clearly agreed to accept the situation, but with bad grace. A few moments later, a horse was led out of the back of the lorry and into the field. The monk blinked. His circuits thrilled and surged with astonishment. Now here at last was something he could believe in, a truly miraculous event, a reward at last for his unstinting, if rather promiscuous, devotion. The horse walked with a patient, uncomplaining gait. It had long grown used to being wherever it was put, but for once it felt it didn't mind this. Here, it thought, was a pleasant field. Here was grass. Here was a hedge it could look at. There was enough space that it could go for a trot later on if it felt the urge. The humans drove off and left it to its own devices, to which it was quite content to be left. It went for a little amble and then, just for the hell of it, stopped ambling. It could do what it liked. What pleasure! What very great and unaccustomed pleasure! It slowly surveyed the whole field and then decided to plan out a nice relaxed day for itself. A little trot later on, I thought, maybe around 3-ish. After that, a bit of a lie down over on the east side of the field where the grass was thicker. It looked like a suitable spot to think about supper in. Lunch, it rather fancied, could be taken at the south end of the field, where a small stream ran. Lunch by a stream, for heaven's sake. This was bliss. It also quite liked the notion of spending half an hour walking alternately a little bit to the left and then a little bit to the right, for no apparent reason. It didn't know whether the time between 2 and 3 would be best spent swishing its tail or mulling things over. Of course, it could always do both if it so wished, and go for its trot a little later. It had just spotted what looked like a fine piece of hedge for watching things over, and that would easily while away a pleasant preprandial hour or two. Good. An excellent plan. And the best thing about it was that having made it, the horse could now completely and utterly ignore it. It went instead for a leisurely stand under the only tree in the field. From out of its branches, the electric monk dropped onto the horse's back with a cry which sounded suspiciously like Geronimo. Chapter 18. Dirk Gently briefly ran over the salient facts once more, while Richard Macduff's world crashed slowly and silently into a dark, freezing sea which he hadn't even known was there, waiting inches beneath his feet. When Dirk had finished for the second time, the room fell quiet, while Richard stared fixedly at his face.
"Where did you hear this?" said Richard at last.
"The radio," said Dirk, with a slight shrug. "At least the main points. It's all over the news, of course. The details, well, discreet inquiries among contacts here and there. There are one or two people I got to know at Cambridge Police Station for reasons which may occur to you."
"I don't even know whether to believe you," said Richard quietly.
"May I use the phone?" Dirk courteously picked a telephone receiver out of the wastepaper bin and handed it to him. Richard dialed Susan's number. The phone was answered almost immediately, and a frightened voice said, "Hello?
Susan, it's Richard, where are you? For God's sake, where are you? Are you all right?"
"Don't tell her where you are," said Dirk.
"Susan, what's happened? Well, don't you... somebody told me that something's happened to Gordon, but something's happened. He's dead, Richard. He's been murdered."
"Hang up," said Dirk.
"Susan, listen, I..."
"Hang up," repeated Dirk, then leaned forward to the phone and cut him off. "The police will probably have a trace on the line," he explained. He took the receiver and chucked it back in the bin.
"But I have to go to the police," Richard exclaimed.
"Go to the police?
Well, what else can I do? I have to go to the police and tell them it wasn't me."
"Tell them that it wasn't you?" said Dirk incredulously.
"Well, I expect that'll probably make it all right then. Pity Dr. Crippen didn't think of that. Would have saved him a lot of bother." "Yes, but he was guilty."
"Yes, so it would appear, and so it would appear at the moment are you."
"But I didn't do it, for God's sake."
"You are talking to someone who has spent time in prison for something he didn't do, remember. I told you that coincidences are strange and dangerous things. Believe me, it is a great deal better to find cast-iron proof that you're innocent than to languish in a cell hoping that the police, who already think you're guilty, will find it for you."
"I can't think straight," said Richard, with his hand to his forehead. "Just stop for a moment and let me think this out."
"If I may..."
"Let me think."
Dirk shrugged and turned his attention back to his cigarette, which seemed to be bothering him.
"It's no good," said Richard, shaking his head after a few moments. "I can't take it in. It's like trying to do trigonometry when someone's kicking your head. Okay, tell me what you think I should do."
"Hypnotism."
"What?"
"It is hardly surprising in the circumstances that you should be unable to gather your thoughts clearly. However, it is vital that somebody gathers them. It'll be much simpler for both of us if you will allow me to hypnotize you. I strongly suspect that there is a very great deal of information jumbled up in your head that will not emerge while you are shaking it up so, that might not emerge at all because you do not realize its significance. With your permission, we can shortcut all that."
"Well, that's decided then," said Richard, standing up. "I'm going to the police."
"Very well," said Dirk, leaning back and spreading his palms on the desk. "I wish you the very best of luck. Perhaps on your way out, you'd be kind enough to ask my secretary to get me some matches."
"You haven't got a secretary," said Richard, and left.
Dirk sat and brooded for a few seconds, made a valiant but vain attempt to fold the sadly empty pizza box into the wastepaper bin, and then went to look in the cupboard for a metronome. Richard emerged blinking into the daylight. He stood on the top step, rocking slightly, then plunged off down the street with an odd kind of dancing walk, which reflected the whirling dance of his mind. On the one hand, he simply couldn't believe that the evidence wouldn't show perfectly clearly that he couldn't have committed the murder. On the other hand, he had to admit that it all looked remarkably odd. He found it impossible to think clearly or rationally about it.
The idea that Gordon had been murdered kept blowing up in his mind and throwing all other thoughts into total confusion and disruption. It occurred to him for a moment that whoever did it must have been a damn fast shot to get the trigger pulled before being totally overwhelmed by waves of guilt, but instantly he regretted the thought. In fact, he was a little appalled by the general quality of the thoughts that sprang into his mind. They seemed inappropriate and unworthy, and mostly had to do with how it would affect his projects in the company. He looked about inside himself for any feeling of great sorrow or regret, and assumed that it must be there somewhere, probably hiding behind the huge wall of shock. He arrived back within sight of Islington Green, hardly noticing the distance he had walked. The sudden sight of the police squad car parked outside his house hit him like a hammer, and he swung on his heel and stared with furious concentration at the menu displayed in the window of a Greek restaurant. Dolmades, he thought frantically. Souvlaki, he thought. A small, spicy Greek sausage passed hectically through his mind. He tried to reconstruct the scene in his mind's eye without turning round. There had been a policeman standing watching the street, and as far as he could recall from the brief glance he had, it looked as if the side door of the building which led up to his flat was standing open. The police were in his flat, Fasolia Plaki, a filling bowl of haricot beans cooked in a tomato and vegetable sauce. He tried to shift his eyes sideways and back over his shoulder. The policeman was looking at him. He yanked his eyes back to the menu and tried to fill his mind with finely ground meat mixed with potato, breadcrumbs, onions and herbs rolled into small balls and fried. The policeman must have recognised him and was at that very moment dashing across the road to grab him and lug him off in a black Maria just as they had done to Dirk all those years ago in Cambridge. He braced his shoulders against the shock, but no hand came to grab him. He glanced back again, but the policeman was looking unconcernedly in another direction. Stiffado. It was very apparent to him that his behaviour was not that of one who was about to go and hand himself in to the police. So what else was he to do? Trying in a stiff, awkward way to walk naturally, he yanked himself away from the window, strolled tensely down the road a few yards, and then ducked back down Camden Passage again, walking fast and breathing hard. Where could he go? To Susan? No, the police would be there a-watching. To the Way Forward offices in Primrose Hill? No, same reason. What on earth, he screamed silently at himself, was he doing suddenly as a fugitive? He insisted to himself, as he had insisted to Dirk, that he should not be running away from the police. The police, he told himself, as he'd been taught when he was a boy, were there to help and protect the innocent. This thought caused him instantly to break into a run, and he nearly collided with the proud new owner of an ugly Edwardian floor lamp. Sorry, he said, sorry. He was startled that anyone should want such a thing, and slowed his pace to a walk, glancing with sharp, hunted looks around him. The very familiar shop fronts, full of old polished brass, old polished wood and pictures of Japanese fish, suddenly seemed very threatening and aggressive. Who could possibly have wanted to kill Gordon? This was the thought that suddenly hammered at him as he turned down Charlton Place. All that had occurred to him so far was that he hadn't. But who had? This was a new thought. Plenty of people didn't care for him much, but there is a huge difference between disliking somebody, maybe even disliking them a lot, and actually shooting them, strangling them, dragging them through the fields and setting their house on fire. It was a difference which kept the vast majority of the population alive from day to day. Was it just theft? Dirk hadn't mentioned anything being missing, but then he hasn't asked him. Dirk, the image of his absurd but oddly commanding figure, sitting like a large toad, brooding in his shabby office, kept insisting itself upon Richard's mind. He realised that he was retracing the way he had come, and deliberately made himself turn right instead of left. That way madness lay. He just needed a space, a bit of time to think and collect his thoughts together. All right, so where was he going? He stopped for a moment, turned around, and then stopped again. The idea of Dolmades suddenly seemed very attractive, and it occurred to him that the cool, calm, and collected course of action would have been simply to walk in and have some. That would have shown fate who was boss. Instead, fate was engaged on exactly the same course of action. It wasn't actually sitting in a Greek restaurant eating Dolmades, but it might as well have been because it was clearly in charge. Richard's footsteps drew him inexorably back through the winding streets, over the canal. He stopped briefly at a corner shop and then hurried on past the council estates and into developer territory again until he was standing once more outside 33 Peckender Street. At about the same time as fate would have been pouring itself the last of the Retsina, wiping its mouth and wondering if it had any room left for baklavas, Richard gazed up at the tall, ruddy Victorian building with its soot-darkened brickwork
and its heavy, forbidding windows. A gust of wind whipped along the street, and a small boy bounded up to him. "Fuck off!" chirped the little boy, then paused and looked at him again. "Here, mister," he added, "can I have your jacket?" "No," said Richard. "Why not?" said the boy. "Because I like it," said Richard. "Can't see why," muttered the boy. "Fuck off!" He slouched off moodily down the street, kicking a stone at a cat. Richard entered the building once more, mounted the stairs uneasily, and looked again into the office. Dirk's secretary was sitting at her desk, head down, arms folded. "I'm not here," she said. "I see," said Richard. "I only came back," she said, without looking up from the spot on her desk at which she was staring angrily, "to make sure he notices that I've gone, otherwise he might just forget." "Is he in?" asked Richard. "Who knows? Who cares? Better ask someone who works for him, because I don't." "Show him in!" boomed Dirk's voice. She glowered for a moment, stood up, went to the inner door, wrenched it open, and said, "Show him in yourself!" slammed the door once more, and returned to her seat. "Why don't I just show myself in?" said Richard. "I can't even hear you," said Dirk's ex-secretary, staring resolutely at her desk. "How do you expect me to hear you if I'm not even here?" Richard made a placatory gesture, which was ignored, and walked through and opened the door to Dirk's office himself. He was startled to find the room in semi-darkness. A blind was drawn down over the window, and Dirk was lounging back in his seat, his face bizarrely lit by the strange arrangement of objects sitting on the desk. At the forward edge of the desk sat an old grey bicycle lamp, facing backwards and shining a feeble light on a metronome which was ticking softly back and forth, with a highly polished silver teaspoon strapped to its metal rod. Richard tossed a couple of boxes of matches onto the desk. "Sit down, relax, and keep looking at the spoon," said Dirk. "You are already feeling sleepy." Another police car pulled itself up to a screeching halt outside Richard's flat, and a grim-faced man climbed out and strode over to one of the constables on duty outside, flashing an identity card. "Detective Inspector Mason, Cambridgeshire CID," he said. "This the Macduff place?" The constable nodded and showed him to the side door entrance, which opened onto the long, narrow staircase leading up to the top flat. Mason bustled in and then bustled straight out again. "There's a sofa halfway up the stairs," he told the constable. "Get it moved." "Some of the lads have already tried, sir," the constable replied anxiously. "It seems to be stuck. Everyone's having to climb over it for the moment, sir. Sorry, sir." Mason gave him another grim look from a vast repertoire he had developed, which ranged from very, very blackly grim indeed, at the bottom of the scale, all the way up to tiredly resigned and only faintly grim, which he reserved for his children's birthdays. "Get it moved," he repeated grimly, and bustled grimly back through the door, grimly hauling up his trousers and coat in preparation for the grim ascent ahead. "No sign of him yet?" asked the driver of the car, coming over himself. "Sergeant Gilkes," he introduced himself. He looked tired. "Not as far as I know," said the constable, "but no one tells me anything." "Know how you feel," agreed Gilkes. "Once the CID gets involved, you just get relegated to driving them about. I'm the only one who knows what he looked like. Stopped him in the road last night. We just came from Way's house. Right mess. Bad night, eh?" "Varied. Everything from murder to hauling horses out of bathrooms. No, don't even ask. Do you have the same cars as these?" he added, pointing at his own. "This one's been driving me crazy all the way up, cold even with the heater on full blast, and the radio keeps turning itself on and off." Chapter 19. The same morning found Michael Wenton Weeks in something of an odd mood. You would need to know him fairly well to know that it was an especially odd mood, because most people regarded him as being a little odd to start with. Few people knew him that well. His mother, perhaps, but there existed between them a state of cold war, and neither had spoken to the other now in weeks. He also had an elder brother, Peter, who was now tremendously senior in the Marines. Apart from at their father's funeral, Michael had not seen Peter since he came back from the Falklands, covered in glory, promotion, and contempt for his younger brother. Peter had been delighted that their mother had taken over Magna, and had sent Michael a regimental Christmas card to that effect. His own greatest satisfaction still remained that of throwing himself into a muddy ditch and firing a machine gun for at least a minute. And he didn't think the British newspaper and publishing industry, even in its current state of unrest, was likely to afford him that pleasure, at least until some more Australians moved into it. Michael had risen very late, after a night of cold savagery and then of troubled dreams, which still disturbed him now in the late morning daylight. His dreams had been filled with the familiar sensations of loss, isolation, guilt, and so forth, but had also been inexplicably involved with large quantities of mud. By the telescopic power of the nightmare of mud and loneliness had seemed to stretch on for terrifying, unimaginable lengths of time, and had only been concluded by the appearance of slimy things with legs that had crawled in the slimy sea. This had been altogether too much, and he had woken with a start in a cold sweat. Though all the business with the mud had seemed strange to him, the sense of loss, of isolation, and above all the aggrievement, the need to undo what had been done, these had all found an easy home in his spirit. Even the slimy things with legs seemed oddly familiar and ticked away irritably at the back of his mind while he made himself a light breakfast, a piece of grapefruit and some China tea, allowed his eyes to rest lightly on the arts pages of the Daily Telegraph for a while, and then rather clumsily changed the dressing on the cuts on his hand. These small tasks accomplished, he was then in two minds as to what to do next. He was able to view the events of the previous night with a cool detachment that he would not have expected. It had been right, it had been proper, it had been correctly done. But it resolved nothing. All that mattered was yet to be done. Or what? He frowned at the odd way his thoughts ebbed and flowed. Normally he would pop along to his club at about this time. It used to be that he would do this with a luxurious sense of the fact that there were many other things that he should be doing. Now there was nothing else to do, which made time spent there, as anywhere else, hang somewhat heavy on his hands. When he went, he would do as he always did, indulge in a gin and tonic and a little light conversation, and then allow his eyes to rest gently on the pages of the Times Literary Supplement, Opera, The New Yorker, or whatever else fell easily to hand. But there was no doubt that he did it these days with less verve and relish than previously. Then there would be lunch. Today he had no lunch date planned, again, and would therefore probably have stayed at his club and eaten a lightly grilled Dover sole with potatoes garnished with parsley and boiled to bits, followed by a large heap of trifle, a glass or two of Sancerre, and coffee, and then the afternoon with whatever that might bring. But today he felt oddly impelled not to do that. He flexed the muscles in his cut hand, poured himself another cup of tea, looked with curious dispassion at the large kitchen knife that still lay by the fine bone china teapot, and waited for a moment to see what he would do next. What he did next, in fact, was to walk upstairs. His house was rather chill in its formal perfection, and looked much as people who buy reproduction furniture would like their houses to look, except, of course, that everything here was genuine, crystal, mahogany, and Wilton, and only looked as if it might be fake because there was no life to any of it. He walked up to his workroom, which was the only room in the house that was not sterile with order, but here the disorder of books and papers was instead sterile with neglect. A thin film of dust had settled over everything. Michael had not been into it in weeks, and the cleaner was under strict instructions to leave it well alone. He had not worked here since he edited the last edition of Fathom. Not, of course, the actual last edition, but the last proper edition, the last edition as far as he was concerned. He set his china cup down in the fine dust and went to inspect his elderly record player. On it he found an elderly recording of some Vivaldi wind concertos, set it to play, and sat down. He waited again to see what he would do next, and suddenly found to his surprise that he was already doing it, and it was this. He was listening to the music. A bewildered look crept slowly across his face as he realized that he had never done this before. He had heard it many, many times, and thought that it made a very pleasant noise. Indeed, he found that it made a pleasant background against which to discuss the concert season, but it had never occurred to him that there was anything actually to listen to. He sat thunderstruck by the interplay of melody and counterpoint, which suddenly stood revealed to him with a clarity that owed nothing to the dust-ridden surface of the record or the 14-year-old stylus. But with this revelation came an almost immediate sense of disappointment, which confused him all the more. The music suddenly revealed to him was oddly unfulfilling. It was as if his capacity to understand the music had suddenly increased up to and far beyond the music's ability to satisfy it, all in one dramatic moment. He strained to listen for what was missing, and felt that the music was like a flightless bird that didn't even know what capacity it had lost. It walked very well, but it walked where it should soar, walked where it should swoop. It walked where it should climb and bank and dive. It walked where it should thrill with the giddiness of flight. It never even looked up. He looked up. After a while, he became aware that all he was doing was simply staring stupidly at the ceiling. He shook his head and discovered that the perception had faded, leaving him feeling slightly sick and dizzy. It had not vanished entirely, but had dropped deep inside him, deeper than he could reach. The music continued. It was an agreeable enough assortment of pleasant sounds in the background, but it no longer stirred him.
He needed some clues as to what it was he had just experienced, and a thought flicked momentarily at the back of his mind as to where he might find them. He let go of the thought in anger, but it flicked at him again and kept on flicking at him until at last he acted upon it. From under his desk he pulled out the large tin waste paper bin. Since he had barred his cleaning lady from even coming in here for the moment, the bin had remained unemptied, and he found in it the tattered shreds of what he was looking for, with the contents of an ashtray emptied over them. He overcame his distaste with grim determination, and slowly jiggled around the bits of the hated object on his desk, clumsily sticking them together with bits of sticky tape, that curled around and stuck the wrong bit to the wrong bit and stuck the right bit to his pudgy fingers and then to the desk, until at last there lay before him, crudely reassembled, a copy of Fathom, as edited by the execrable creature A.K. Ross. Appalling. He turned the sticky, lumpish pages as if he were picking over chicken giblets. Not a single line drawing of Joan Sutherland or Marilyn Horne anywhere. No profiles of any of the major Cork Street art dealers, not a one. His series on the Rosettes, discontinued. Greenroom gossip, discontinued. He shook his head in incredulity, and then he found the article he was after. Music and Fractal Landscapes by Richard Macduff. He skipped over the first couple of paragraphs of introduction and picked it up further on. Mathematical analysis and computer modelling are revealing to us that the shapes and processes we encounter in nature, the way that plants grow, the way that mountains erode or rivers flow, the way that snowflakes or islands achieve their shapes, the way that light plays on a surface, the way the milk folds and spins into your coffee as you stir it, the way that laughter sweeps through a crowd of people, all these things in their seemingly magical complexity can be described by the interaction of mathematical processes that are, if anything, even more magical in their simplicity. Shapes that we think of as random are in fact the products of complex shifting webs of numbers obeying simple rules. The very word natural, that we have often taken to mean unstructured, in fact describes shapes and processes that appear so unfathomably complex that we cannot consciously perceive the simple natural laws at work. They can all be described by numbers. Oddly, this idea seemed less revolting now to Michael than it had done on his first scant reading. He read on with increasing concentration. We know, however, that the mind is capable of understanding these matters in all their complexity and in all their simplicity. A ball flying through the air is responding to the force and direction with which it was thrown, the action of gravity, the friction of the air which it must expend its energy on overcoming, the turbulence of the air around its surface, and the rate and direction of the ball's spin. And yet, someone who might have difficulty consciously trying to work out what 3 × 4 × 5 comes to would have no trouble in doing differential calculus and a whole host of related calculations so astoundingly fast that they can actually catch a flying ball. People who call this instinct are merely giving the phenomenon a name, not explaining anything. I think that the closest that human beings come to expressing our understanding of these natural complexities is in music. It is the most abstract of the arts. It has no meaning or purpose other than to be itself. Every single aspect of a piece of music can be represented by numbers. From the organization of movements in a whole symphony, down to the patterns and pitch of rhythm that make up the melodies and harmonies, the dynamics that shape the performance, all the way down to the timbres of the notes themselves, their harmonics, the way they change over time, in short, all the elements of a noise that distinguish between the sound of one person piping on a piccolo and another one thumping a drum. All of these things can be expressed by patterns and hierarchies of numbers. And in my experience, the more internal relationships there are between the patterns of numbers at different levels of the hierarchy, however complex and subtle those relationships may be, the more satisfying and, well, whole the music will seem to be. In fact, the more subtle and complex those relationships, and the more they are beyond the grasp of the conscious mind, the more the instinctive part of your mind, by which I mean that part of your mind that can do differential calculus so astoundingly fast that it will put your hand in the right place to catch a flying ball, the more that part of your brain revels in it. Music of any complexity, and even Three Blind Mice is complex in its way by the time someone has actually performed it on an instrument with its own individual timbre and articulation, passes beyond your conscious mind into the arms of your own private mathematical genius, who dwells in your unconscious, responding to all the inner complexities and relationships and proportions that we think we know nothing about. Some people object to such a view of music, saying that if you reduce music to mathematics, where does the emotion come into it? I would say that it's never been out of it.
The things by which our emotions can be moved, the shape of a flower or a Grecian urn, the way a baby grows, the way the wind brushes across your face, the way clouds move, their shapes, the way light dances on the water or daffodils flutter in the breeze, the way in which the person you love moves their head, the way their hair follows that movement, the curve described by the dying fall of the last chord of a piece of music. All these can be described by the complex flow of numbers. That's not a reduction of it, that's the beauty of it. Ask Newton, ask Einstein. Ask the poet, Keats, who said that what the imagination seizes as beauty must be truth. He might also have said that what the hand seizes as a ball must be truth, but he didn't, because he was a poet and preferred loafing about under trees with a bottle of laudanum and a notebook to playing cricket, but it would have been equally true. This jogged a thought at the back of Michael's memory, but he couldn't immediately place it. Because that is at the heart of the relationship between, on the one hand, our instinctive understanding of shape, form, movement, light, and on the other hand, our emotional responses to them. And that is why I believe that there must be a form of music inherent in nature, in natural objects, in the patterns of natural processes. A music that would be as deeply satisfying as any naturally occurring beauty. And our own deepest emotions are, after all, a form of naturally occurring beauty. Michael stopped reading and let his gaze gradually drift from the page. He wondered if he knew what such a music would be and tried to grope in the dark recesses of his mind for it. Each part of his mind that he visited seemed as if that music had been playing there only seconds before, and all that was left was the last dying echo of something he was unable to catch at and hear. He laid the magazine limply aside. Then he remembered what it was that the mention of Keats had jogged in his memory, the slimy things with legs from his dream. A cold calm came over him as he felt himself coming very close to something. Coleridge, that man. Yea, slimy things did crawl with legs upon the slimy sea, the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. Dazed, Michael walked over to the bookshelf and pulled down his Coleridge anthology. He took it back to his seat, and with a certain apprehension, he riffled through the pages until he found the opening lines. It is an ancient mariner, and he stoppeth one of three. The words were very familiar to him, and yet as he read on through them, they awoke in him strange sensations and fearful memories that he knew were not his. There reared up inside him a sense of loss and desolation of terrifying intensity, which, while he knew it was not his own, resonated so perfectly now with his own aggrievements that he could not but surrender to it absolutely. And a thousand slimy things lived on, and so did I. Chapter 20. The blind rolled up with a sharp rattle, and Richard blinked. "A fascinating evening you appear to have spent," said Dirk gently, "even though the most interesting aspects of it seem to have escaped your curiosity entirely." He returned to his seat and lounged back in it, pressing his fingertips together. "Please," he said, "do not disappoint me by saying, 'Where am I? A glance will suffice.'" Richard looked around him in slow puzzlement, and felt as if he were returning unexpectedly from a long sojourn on another planet, where all was peace and light and music that went on and on for ever. He felt so relaxed he could hardly be bothered to breathe. The wooden toggle on the end of the blind cord knocked a few times against the window, but otherwise all was now silent. The metronome was still. He glanced at his watch. It was just after 1 o'clock. "You have been under hypnosis for a little less than an hour," said Dirk, "during which I have learnt many interesting things, and been puzzled by some others which I would now like to discuss with you. A little fresh air will probably help revive you, and I suggest a bracing stroll along the canal. No one will be looking for you there. Janice!" Silence. A lot of things were still not clear to Richard, and he frowned to himself. When his immediate memory returned a moment later, it was like an elephant suddenly barging through the door, and he sat up with a startled jolt. "Janice!" shouted Dirk again. "Miss Pierce! Damn the girl!" He yanked the telephone receivers out of the waste paper basket and replaced them. An old and battered leather briefcase stood by the desk, and he picked this up, retrieved his hat from the floor, and stood up, screwing his hat absurdly on his head. "Come," he said, sweeping through the door to where Miss Janice Pierce sat glaring at a pencil. "Let us go. Let us leave this festering hellhole. Let us think the unthinkable. Let us do the undoable. Let us prepare to grapple with the ineffable itself, and see if we may not eff it after all. Now, Janice, shut up!" Dirk shrugged, and then picked off her desk the book which earlier she had mutilated when trying to slam her drawer. He leafed through it frowning, and then replaced it with a sigh. Janice returned to what she had clearly been doing a moment or two earlier, which was writing a long note with the pencil. Richard regarded all this in silence, still feeling only semi-present. He shook his head. Dirk said to him, "Events may seem to you to be a tangled mass of confusion at the moment, and yet we have some interesting threads to pull on. For of all the things you have told me that have happened, only two are actually physically impossible." Richard spoke at last. "Impossible?" he said with a frown. "Yes," said Dirk, "completely and utterly impossible." He smiled. "Luckily, you have come to exactly the right place with your interesting problem, for there is no such word as impossible in my dictionary. In fact," he added, brandishing the abused book, "everything between herring and marmalade appears to be missing. Thank you, Miss Pierce. You have once again rendered me sterling service, for which I thank you, and will, in the event of a successful outcome to this endeavour, even attempt to pay you. In the meantime, we have much to think on, and I leave the office in your very capable hands." The phone rang, and Janice answered it. "Good afternoon," she said. "Wainwright's Fruit Emporium. Mr. Wainwright is not able to take calls at this time, since he is not right in the head and thinks he is a cucumber. Thank you for calling." She slammed the phone down. She looked up again to see the door closing softly behind her ex-employer and his befuddled client. "Impossible," said Richard again in surprise. "Everything about it," insisted Dirk. "Completely and utterly, well, let us say, inexplicable. There is no point in using the word impossible to describe something that has clearly happened, but it cannot be explained by anything we know." The briskness of the air along the Grand Union Canal got in amongst Richard's senses and sharpened them up again. He was restored to his normal faculties, and though the fact of Gordon's death kept jumping at him all over again every few seconds, he was at least now able to think more clearly about it. Oddly enough, though, that seemed for the moment to be the last thing on Dirk's mind. Dirk was instead picking on the most trivial of the night's sequence of bizarre events on which to cross-examine him. A jogger going one way and a cyclist going the other both shouted at each other to get out of the way, and narrowly avoided hurling each other into the murky, slow-moving waters of the canal. They were watched carefully by a very slow-moving old lady who was dragging an even slower-moving old dog. On the other bank, large empty warehouses stood startled, every window shattered and glinting. A burnt-out barge lolled brokenly in the water. Within it, a couple of detergent bottles floated in the brackish water. Over the nearest bridge, heavy goods lorries thundered, shaking the foundations of the houses, belching petrol fumes into the air, and frightening a mother trying to cross the road with her pram. Richard and Dirk were walking along from the fringes of South Hackney, a mile from Dirk's office, back towards the heart of Islington, where Dirk knew the nearest life belts were positioned. "But it was only a conjuring trick, for heaven's sake," said Richard. "He does them all the time. It's just sleight of hand. Looks impossible, but I'm sure if you asked any conjurer, he'd say it's easy once you know how these things are done. I once saw a man in New York doing..." "I know how these things are done," said Dirk, pulling two lighted cigarettes and a large glazed fig out of his nose. He tossed the fig up into the air, but it somehow failed to land anywhere. "Dexterity, misdirection, suggestion, all things you can learn if you have a little time to waste. Excuse me, dear lady," he said to the elderly, slow-moving dog owner as they passed her. He bent down to the dog and pulled a long string of brightly coloured flags from its bottom. "I think he will move more comfortably now," he said, tipped his hat courteously to her, and moved on. "These things, you see," he said to a flummoxed Richard, "are easy. Sawing a lady in half is easy. Sawing a lady in half and then joining her up together again is less easy, but can be done with practice. The trick you described to me with the 200-year-old vase and the college salt cellar is," he paused for emphasis, "completely and utterly inexplicable." "Well, there was probably some detail of it I missed, but..." "Oh, without question. But the benefit of questioning somebody under hypnosis is that it allows the questioner to see the scene in much greater detail than the subject was even aware of at the time. The girl Sarah, for instance, do you recall what she was wearing?"
No, said Richard vaguely. A dress of some kind, I suppose.
Colour? Fabric?"
"Well, I can't remember. It was dark. She was sitting several places away from me. I hardly glimpsed her."
"She was wearing," said Dirk, "a dark blue cotton velvet dress gathered to a dropped waist. It had raglan sleeves gathered to the cuffs, a white Peter Pan collar, and six small pearl buttons down the front. The third one down had a small thread hanging off it. She had long dark hair pulled back with a red butterfly hair grip." "If you're going to tell me you know all that from looking at a scuff mark on my shoes like Sherlock Holmes, then I'm afraid I don't believe you."
"No, no, no," said Dirk. "It's much simpler than that. You told me yourself under hypnosis."
Richard shook his head. "Not true," he said. "I don't even know what a Peter Pan collar is."
"But I do," said Dirk, and you described it to me perfectly accurately, as you did the conjuring trick, and that trick was not possible in the form in which it occurred. Believe me, I know whereof I speak. There are some other things I would like to discover about the professor, like, for instance, who wrote the note you discovered on the table, and how many questions George III actually asked, but... What? But I think I would do better to question the fellow directly. Except, he frowned deeply in concentration, except, he added, that being rather vain in these matters, I would prefer to know the answers before I asked the questions. And I do not. I absolutely do not.
Voor degelijke uitvoering en verantwoorde vormgeving beleefd aanbevelen
Beans & Co.
U wilt de man zeker even spreken? Ja, dat verbindt u even. Wat zegt u? Of ik niet vind dat u uw man wat vaak op de zaak belt, zegt u? Wel nee, mevrouw Soetewolbanjer. U bent dus op het pas in het OJ-stadium, hè? Nee, het OJ-stadium. Weet u niet wat het is? Nee, maar het is iets wat je haar fijn deed onderscheiden, hè? Als je aan de telefoon zit, hoe ver zo'n huwelijk gevorderd is, weet u wel? Weet u niet? Ja, zeker zeg. Kijk, het begint altijd met het verraste oh. Hè? Natuurlijk nog nieuw is dus. De eerste 2, 3 jaren zo ongeveer, als ik doorverbind dan, hè? Zo van, meneer Pietersen, ik heb uw vrouw aan de lijn. Oh. Ja, en dan gaat het een beetje verwateren, hè? Dan wordt het meer iets van, meneer Pietersen, uw vrouw aan de lijn. Oh. Dat feitelijk meer, hè? Oh. En daarna krijg je dan achtereenvolgens het berustende, oh jee. Het kribbige, hé nee. Het norse, wat nou weer. En het vermoeide, oh dat nog. En het bezwerende, ik ben er niet. Nou, en u bent pas bij het berustende, oh jee. Hè? Dus wie doet u wat? Kom, ik ga u even doorverbinden, hè? Wat zegt u mevrouw Soetewolbanje? Oh, het heeft niet zo'n haast. Nee, ik begrijp het. Dan laat ik uw mama gewoon in zijn werk, hè? Ja, graag gedaan hoor, mevrouw Soetewolbanje. Daai! Zo, weer een stukje arbeidsproductiviteit en de dorrend huwelijk ontworstel.
Ja, het heeft niks menselijks, hè? Nee, je hebt er geen contact mee. Het is net als met bloemen of gebakken aardappeltjes of beestjes, kleine beestjes. Het is mooi of lekker of ontroerend. Maar contact heb je er niet mee. Goedemorgen.
Morgen, meneer Biels.
Morgen, ik bedoel, er gebeurt niks, hè. Er vindt niks plaats. Je kijkt elkaar maar eens aan en je lacht maar eens. Maar verder dan een soort van veredeld bekken trekken kom je niet.
Zelden.
Hoogstelden.
Bij hoge uitzondering.
Zeg maar nooit.
Maar waar hebben we het over?
Over gisteravond.
Iets gebeurd?
Hè, nee, nee, dat is nou juist het onwaarschijnlijke. Dat er in feite niks gebeurd is. Maar dat wordt dan verkeerd uitgelegd, hè. Dat blaast men dan op. Dan gaat men iets achterzoeken. Achter mijn beer, bijvoorbeeld.
Je wat?
Mijn beer.
Wat voor beer?
Gewoon mijn beer. Speelgoedbeer. Waar ik mee door de laan liep, dus, hè. En daar zoekt men dan iets achter, kennelijk.